Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Minnesota House of Representatives Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee for this May 12th. This is a special post-deadline hearing. We have a number of items that have been brought to our attention, some more recently than others, that are important for us to hear. One bill we will be moving out of committee, the other are for informational purposes, but all have some relevance to conversations that continue ongoing at the Capitol on transportation issues, particularly as the conference committee does its work. So we appreciate everybody coming, particularly at this hour and at this time of session. So as we normally do, we'll start with our committee legislative assistant, Dan Dodge, will take the role of the committee. Mr. Dodge.
Chair Hornstein.
Present.
Hornstein, present. Vice Chair Cagle.
Present.
Cagle, present. Representative Petersburg.
Present.
Petersburg, present. Representative Barr.
Here.
Barr, present. Representative Bernardi.
Bernardi, present.
Bernardi, present. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, present.
Elkins, present. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Frederick, present. Representative Hausman.
Present.
Hausman, present. Representative Heinrich.
Heinrich, present.
Heinrich, present. Representative Kosnick.
Kosnick, present.
Kosnick, present. Representative Mason. Representative Mason. Representative Murphy. Representative Murphy. Representative Nelson. Representative Nelson. Representative Olson.
Present.
Olson, present. Representative Richardson. Representative Richardson. Representative Torkelson.
Torkelson, present.
Torkelson, present. Representative West.
West, present.
West, present. There is a quorum.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dodge. I will hand over the virtual gavel to Chair Cagle at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So members, testifiers, so Chair Hornstein, you have House File 4818. Would you like to move your bill?
Yeah, I'd like to move House File 4818 to the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee.
All right. So moved, and Chair Hornstein, please explain your bill to us.
Thank you, members. And this bill is before us. You may recall, members, that we heard an overview of this bill or concept when the Department of Public Safety gave us their recommendation, governor's recommendations for the supplemental budget. That was the initial supplemental budget, not the revised supplemental budget. We included it in our bill, and it was part of our walkthrough, but we did find out following that that there was a mandatory referral to Judiciary, and we weren't able to, at that late moment, move that bill to Judiciary. But this is a really important bill for a variety of reasons. You'll hear testimony about that, and we would like this to be part of the end of session conversation. So that is why the bill is before you. In essence, I'll just give a quick summary and we can go right to testimony and then questions after that. But the bill authorizes the Department of Public Safety, Driver and Vehicle Services Division to collect race and ethnicity data as part of the driver's license application process. This is a voluntary, I will emphasize voluntary, process. The information would be self-identified and, of course, optional to provide. Not providing and providing information will have no impact on the driver's license or application process. The information would not be printed on the license, would not be available to law enforcement. Currently, there's no data available on a statewide basis relating to race, ethnicity, and traffic stop citations. And so this data could be used as an important tool to help study the topic of racial profiling in the state, particularly in traffic stops. We don't know if or how large a problem this might be until we have data. So we know that this is, there have other states that have been utilizing this, I think, to good and positive effect. So data collection will help us ensure that there's a level of transparency in traffic law enforcement. This transparency and equity will help build a community trust in law enforcement agencies and traffic enforcement activities. So there are a lot of important ideas and concepts embedded in this bill. And if it's okay, Chair Cagle, we have several people who have signed up to testify, and I think you have their names and titles.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. I understand Commissioner Harrington is here to testify briefly on the proposal as well as others. I'd like to be respectful of everyone's time, so we'd like to ask that we hear from all of our testifiers and then turn to member questions. I also understand Commissioner Harrington may need to depart early from this meeting to attend Public Safety Conference Committee, but we have DPS staff on hand to answer any questions. And so it, can you guys hear me still?
Yeah, we can hear you quite well. Good.
Sorry, okay. Commissioner Harrington, welcome to the committee. If you could proceed with your testimony.
Chair Cagle. Chair Hornstein, members of the committee, thank you very much. For the record, my name is John Harrington. I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, and I'm happy to be here to present some information on this proposal. I want to start with a little background that and it really speaks to why we propose this from the Department of Public Safety. Police departments benefit when the public has both a clear and a transparent view of their operations. This is generally termed procedurally just or procedural justice. And I want you to know that the literature, both the criminal justice and public safety literature, and my 44 years of practice as a peace officer confirm that when the public has confidence in government, and in particular in their police departments, sheriff's departments, state patrols, when they have confidence in those entities treating them fairly, they respond with greater trust. And with greater trust, with that attitude, we see the public increase voluntary compliance and adherence to the law. So they're safer. They're safer because they're driving safer. They're not doing things that would put them in jeopardy. We also see less confrontations between police and the public over the law and the enforcement of the law, which means you see less officers injured. You see less cases where the public gets injured, you see less confrontations that result in lawsuits and other things. That really is, in my mind, it equates to two win-win cases: greater public safety, greater traffic safety, and greater officer safety. And I think that's why so many peace officers support this idea of procedurally just activities. But I will say to you, and in no small response, you know, the recent enlightening developments with the Minnesota Department of Human Rights' case against Minneapolis, that we are at a crossroads in trust between the public and the police. And in many parts of that state, we see that breakdown. And I can tell you that it's not necessarily just a recent breakdown, and it's not just limited to Minneapolis. As a St. Paul cop, back in my misspent youth, we heard from the community during the 90s that there were fears about racial profiling, which at the time it was termed generally driving while Black or driving while brown. At that time, Chief Bill Finney, who was my chief, mandated a data collection process that had cops copying down data or recording data that was later analyzed by the Council on Crime and Justice, the predecessor of the CJRC. And once the results were in, it allowed folks like me, who was a commander of a district, to have a conversation with the folks in Frogtown and the folks in Highland Park and the folks in Como about what that data showed. And it allowed us to build a trusting relationship around the conversation about traffic enforcement and around both. In many cases, we were able to clearly debunk the fact that somebody was racial profiling. And in some cases, it helped the chief of police make good policy decisions about what should we be doing if we did have officers that were acting in a biased fashion. That really has followed through in that department with Chief Smith, now Chief Axel. He refers to it as the trust bank, that working in a transparent mode with the community really does allow for you to build that trust bank. And I can tell you that without trust, you don't get witnesses and victims of crimes to come forward. You don't get young recruits to want to step up and join police departments. Here in Minnesota, the Department of Public Safety often gets asked about biased policing. And while we're not in charge, for the record, of any other police agencies other than the State Patrol and the BCA and alcohol gambling, there is an expectation that we have seen that the state is perhaps in the best position to assist, and especially in answering question about bias. And that is, I think, no small part because the State Patrol patrols all of the highways throughout the state, regardless of what county or jurisdiction you're in. And it also is because the Department of Vehicle Services licenses every driver in the state of Minnesota, and therefore has the body of evidence and the body of information. But it's an incomplete body of information because we do not have race data available for analysis. Now, I want you to be clear that, you know, be clear that no one is, you know, there's no cop that I know of who supports biased policing. And, you know, whether it's the National Associations of Police Organizations, the IACP or NOBLE, everyone is saying the same thing, that we are against bias-based policing. But how do you fix something that you can't count? In every other kind of, whether it's a public health, an economics, we count the problem and then we are able to analyze the problem so that we can start to fix it. But without the data, you are working blind. You're working off of anecdotes, you're working off of stories. And what we're suggesting is that we want to move from anecdotal information to actually having the data. Our policy that we proposed has a very clear intent. We propose to collect race and ethnicity data at the time that an individual submits a driver's license or identification card application. This will connect the individual's self-identified race to their driving record. We think that's a more accurate way of getting the data, because otherwise, if you ask the person at the counter to guess, or you ask the cop on the road to guess, it is just that, it is a guess. And so it is far more accurate. And in fact, it is what the Government Accounting Office and the Department of Justice recommend as a mean for collecting data. As Chair Hornstein has mentioned, the submission of one's race and ethnicity is voluntary. No one is compelled to do this. We believe that, like many other of the questions that we get asked on surveys and on government forms, that most people will, in fact, just voluntarily check the box that represents them, the same way we do it on the census and the same way we do it on lots of other federal forms that we fill out regularly. We believe that people will, in fact, voluntarily do this. The options that we would use to self-identify will be, in fact, the same options as used on the United States Census Bureau forms. So they're terms that everybody, every adult is familiar with. It is important to note that the race and ethnicity data will not be accessible to law enforcement officers who could be making traffic stops. It won't be on the card. It won't be on the data that shows up on their mobile data terminal. It won't be visible to them. So for those that had concerns about this may, in fact, create racial profiling, because cops could then check the race of somebody by simply running driver's licenses, that will not be allowed and would not be accessible to them. We believe that this information should be classified as private data under data practices. We believe that makes it gives it the most privacy protections. And our intent is to have the data in summary bulk form given to the Office of Traffic Safety to do a studies of disparities. It will begin the process once we have the data to be able to start answering the question, are there disparities? And if so, where are they specifically related to traffic stops? We believe that by completing this thorough analysis of traffic stop data, along with the racial ethnic identity, we'll be able to create solutions and strategies that will help eliminate patterns and practices that result in disparate treatment. We'll be able to create better training. We'll be able to create educational products, all of which will be better keyed to success. As I said, data collection will help ensure procedural justice and I'll increase the level of transparency that is maintained in traffic law enforcement across the state by having this done. It won't be limited to simply the state patrol. It will give us a statewide picture. And I think that's a really important piece that in times where I'm asking individual departments to do more, and they oftentimes don't have the resources to do it, this would give them an asset that they would be able to access readily. Transparent equity, it will help build that community trust that Chair Hornstein mentioned so far. And we believe that effective traffic and law enforcement that is both transparent, equitable, and procedurally just will improve public safety, traffic safety, and officer safety, and improve the quality of life of folks in general. Very briefly, our proposal asked for $418,000 the first year and $166,000 in the tails. We believe that we are, first of all, not the first that are undertaking this. 2011, Connecticut started doing it. Colorado is probably a little more recent. They've done it the same way we're doing it, or largely doing it the same way in 2016. There are several other states that are looking at this legislation. But in closing, I think what makes this proposal important is the issue of building trust with our communities around traffic safety. I believe that making this a voluntary activity will get us what we need in terms of the data. And we believe it will provide us with the statistical information, will help us do a better job, that will help answer questions about disparate treatment in one of the most frequent encounters between the government and the public. And it will do so in a fair, impartial, and procedurally just manner. And with that, I would stand for questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Harrington. Representative Kosnick, I see your hand up. Would you mind if we continue with testifiers, or is this to Chief Harrington?
It is actually to Chief Harrington, Madam Chair. And since he's short on time, I would appreciate it.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd suggest. Yeah, thank you, Representative Kosnick. Madam Chair, I'd suggest perhaps if there are specific questions to the commissioner that we take those down.
Okay, sounds good. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you. Chief Harrington, you'd mentioned that you'd implemented something similar to this with different data collection techniques in Highland Park and a couple other areas, and it resulted in changing of policy. Can you give us some examples of what those changes of policies were and how effective they were?
Commissioner Harrington.
Representative Kosnick, Chair Cagle, yes. So our policies, for example, on when did we search cars, changed after we recognized that there were some disparate impacts there. We began using, requiring more search warrants and being more rigorous in having supervisors involved in the decision about when and if you searched a car. So that was one policy change. I think a lot of this was less about policy change and more about the transparency with the community being listened to, with the community knowing that their voices were being heard and that their concerns were being addressed and that they were not being dismissed without any effort to look into the matters that they had as concerns.
I'll leave it at that. Thank you. That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Commissioner Harrington? Seeing no hands going up, I thank you, Commissioner Harrington. And we will move on then to Professor Chris Eugen.
That's correct.
Yay. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Christopher Eugen. Thank you, Chair Cagle and Chair Hornstein. My name is Chris Eugen. I've been a professor of sociology and law at the University of Minnesota since 1995. My primary areas of research are in teaching crime, justice, and inequality. I was delighted as a researcher to hear that the House is considering this bill. And I'm glad to offer some comments on what it's like on the research side. I've published some work on low-level traffic records, racial inequality, monetary sanctions, and related subjects. As of today, a large share of our cases in our state court data systems have no data available on race. In one recent article by my team, about 43% of the total data were missing across all cases, and about two-thirds of the petty misdemeanor and traffic cases were missing data. So what we have is pretty spotty. The addition of voluntary self-reported race data would not only improve the completeness, as Commissioner Harrington mentioned, it would also improve the representativeness and the accuracy of this information. And I can't emphasize enough how self-identified information is much preferable to that that's reported by outside observers. It's a classic methodology class lecture in which exercise in which we ask people to do racial classification based on pictures and phenotypes, and the students are stymied at how difficult it is, and this to ask our public officials to and officers to do this is a large task. So not only are these data invaluable for research, but clearly also for policy. I'm engaged in several local efforts to address trust and racial disparities in Minneapolis and in greater Minnesota. And it's difficult to improve something if we cannot measure it, as the commissioner mentioned. Better data would allow us to track progress, I think, in particular, to identify areas of concern and address public concerns about racial profiling and fairness. There are, as mentioned, some important implementation considerations. One is that the census category does have two items, one regarding race and a separate one on ethnicity. And I'd say our current state court data just has a combined indicator there. So that is, there's no separate Hispanic indicator. And that would just something important to consider. Then also, I think the privacy issues, data privacy issues. I can say as a researcher, because race is a private field, we obtained permission from the state Supreme Court to analyze those data, and we analyzed them in a secure University of Minnesota facility that's called MinLink on the St. Paul campus that is very heavily protected, and no individual information is ever presented in any of the research articles or reports. It is only at the group level that we present that. So in my view, these considerations require some attention, but are quite manageable. And this bill would play a big part in getting a more complete, accurate, and timely information regarding race and justice in Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we will move on to Christy Snyder. If you could just introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Thank you so much for inviting me to speak today, Chair Hornstein and Chair Cagle. My name is Christy Snyder, and I'm the director of the Emerging Twin Cities Opportunity Youth Network at Youth Prize. We're a network of organizations, both elder and youth-led, that prioritize the needs of opportunity youth. So young people aged 15 to 25 that have been in the foster care system, justice system, unsheltered youth, young parents, and or young people that have been disconnected from school and work. And together we strive for narrative shifts, changes to practice, resources, and policy change. Young people have identified issues with the driver's license as their top concern. National data shows a dramatic change. In the 1970s, about 95% of drivers received free driver's education at school. Today, less than 15% of young people receive that public good. The rest of them have to pay for privatized driver's instruction, as much as $800 or more. This means that many young people delay or don't receive this instruction, and many don't get their licenses. What happened? How did it impact different groups of young Minnesotans? We don't know, because we've not been collecting data on driver's license applications, including race and ethnicity data. Using national survey data, Schulste, Van Dream, and Perry identified that young people of color were about 1.8 to 2.5 times more likely to be non-drivers than their white peers. It's also important to figure out at what age different populations are getting their licenses, which has a big impact on career options. Think green jobs, think construction, the risk of driving without a license and getting caught up with law enforcement, and the path to financial stability. And I'm most interested in figuring out the age of when people of color are getting their licenses. Do we have more young people of color, Black and Indigenous people waiting until they're 18 to bypass driver's education that can cost up to $800? Young drivers who have not completed driver's education are 75% more likely to get traffic tickets. They're 24% more likely to be involved in an injury, including fatal injuries. So we have functionally established a system where Black, Indigenous, and people of color are simply waiting until they're 18 to bypass privatized driver's education, the privatized driver's education system, and then attempting to get their license. And we're leaving them open to more interactions with police in these volatile climate and possible death. But we don't know because we don't collect the data. And it's easy to keep yet another educational gap, a life gap, out of sight and out of mind. But if we pass this House File 4818 into law, we can start to measure the impact of our decisions on the young people in our state. So I urge the committee to pass this on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Next up is Justin Terrell. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Chair Hornstein. Thank you so much for the opportunity. My name is Justin Terrell, and I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Justice Research Center. We are an organization that was founded in 2017 by Tom Johnson, who was a former founder of the Council on Crime and Justice. And our mission is to transform the criminal legal system through research, education, and policy development. We do our best to center our work in community. We work really well with government institutions, providing advice and strategies to the legislature and the governor as well. And we are excited to support this policy. It just makes sense. If you consider what we've been through in the last couple of weeks with the release of the NDHR report, it points clearly to a problem with race and trust and the ability to build trust between communities of color and law enforcement. The other thing I want to highlight about that report is that it is actually the city's data. It is the department's data. It is testimony from officers. And what we realized, what I want to elevate there is that the information coming from the system, the in charge of policing, is so important to have clear data and to be able to reflect on those experiences to identify these kinds of patterns and practices. We also worked with the Department of Public Safety on the Water Research Report in reaction to the uprising. And I would point members to the appendix in that report that centers the voices of communities that talk about their experiences with law enforcement during that time. I also want to commend Commissioner Harrington for some of the things that he said that literally could have came from my notes, that this is a fair procedure and that we need to focus on, when it comes to these type of policies, we need to focus on key principles of justice, such as, fair procedures, equitable distribution of resources, enhanced accountability, and ensuring that all outcomes from our justice system are actually restorative in nature. And I think that this policy does that. We have a huge problem with data. If you look at the state of Connecticut, you can look back years and years and years of reports that track this important race data that allows them to understand what kind of patterns and practices they've developed. You can't fix a problem if you don't have the information. And one of the things that we strive to do at our organization is to affirm people so that we can end this gaslighting that happens in communities of color who have been screaming racial discrimination for a very long time. There's no data to provide the support and justification for this body to act. And so I want to commend you all for considering this bill. I hope you understand that it is part of a solution to a very big problem, that these kind of self-reporting is a great idea. Having it be privatized data, having it be private data, classified as private data, is a great idea. These things ensure that people, that the state's not misusing this information, but rather that it is taking advantage of opportunity to respectfully and responsibly document its own practices and how it shows up in communities of color. I think that concludes my notes. And I'm very happy to be testifying along folks like Chris Ugin and Christy Snyder and Commissioner Arrington, who all in one way or another way interact with our organization. And so thank you for this opportunity, and I'm excited to see this policy move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Terrell. All right, members, we have time for some questions. So is there any questions from the committee? All right, seeing none, Chair Hornstein, would you like
to? I have a question.
Oh, wait, oh, I see hands. Okay, hands are popping up. Go ahead, Representative Kosnick.
To the author, maybe any of the testifiers, maybe the professor from the University of Minnesota. So my question would focuses on, generally we think of data as only, and the aggregated information is only as good as the integrity of the data that you put in. So is there any concerns that this is self-identified and not mandatory reporting of data or your self-identifying race, that the aggregated data is not really 100% accurate? Is there any concerns with that? Because it does kind of goes against the general data collection practices, I would think. So would be interested in some comments on that.
Mr. Ugin?
Yes, thank you, Chair Cagle. I can speak to that to some extent. We do have, by social science standards, I'd say self-reported race data are very high quality, and we don't have a statistical problem often in estimating the population, and that, you know, we have population data rather than just a sample in a situation like this. But we do have non-response, and non-response in race can be modeled fairly effectively, and it's something that social scientists do quite a bit. One of the ways we adjust for that, for example, is that in calculating the group estimates across race, we also include adjustment terms for when race is missing and when it is present, and we can then adjust for non-response. I say that, but I anticipate that this will be a relatively a small share of those will be skipping this item, but typically we have don't know, is one answer, refused or unknown, and those categories together, you know, often make up, say, I think in our felony level records in the state court administrative data, it's about 9%, and then we model that 9% that's missing, and then estimate things where we try to include our statistical adjustments for that. And then we model that where we ignore that information, et cetera, and see whether the picture changes at all. So I apologize for the wonky answer on that, Representative Kosnick, but this is it's a central issue. And I think relative to other data systems, the driver's license data are quite good. I'd be more worried, frankly, about using self-reported weight data on the driver's license, perhaps, than race. Thank you.
Representative Kosnick?
He must have been looking at my driver's license, the weight too. I put on there, I guess. Huh? I appreciate the answer, and I think it does bring up an issue of the integrity of the data if I kind of understood the answer. So for non-reporting and some other factors, they may use modeling, which is a very good guess, I would suggest, and maybe worse than that. So I think that needs a little bit of exploring. I appreciate where the bill intent is headed, but I think that the data portion of it and being self-reported and not a complete picture with some guessing and stuff, I think that there's some concerns and some work that needs to be fleshed out on that. But thank you for the answer.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. Representative Mason.
Thank you. I guess this is kind of a follow-up to the previous question. If this is going to be self-reporting I guess my question is, how many people would voluntarily want to give up more of their personal information? Especially if there's already a matter of distrust that currently exists. And I'm assuming other states would have some background on that, but I find this one really hard to understand that a lot of people would voluntarily do this.
Not sure who wants to.
Sure, Kegel. I can jump in just a little bit to say. So Colorado is probably our most closely comparable state. They have the same driver and vehicle services system that we operate here. And it's very, I think their process is similar to ours. And in their first 4 years, I think they are at 40%. And you think about it, the fact that you have driver's license renewals every year or so. So you're building that database over the time. But I think theirs is at 40% currently, which is a pretty significant amount of the millions of people that are getting driver's license renewed on an annual basis. So while 40% may not sound like a lot, it's really millions and millions of people that have voluntarily done that in Colorado. That's the closest correlate that I have right now.
Thank you, Chief. One more question. We really need to get on to a vote. Is there a quick follow-up, Representative Meeson?
Well, just can you tell from the 40%, is it a pretty much the average of the state population, or is it strictly certain populations or age groups that are volunteering the information?
Commissioner Harrington?
I can't give you that level of breakdown right now from what I know of their process. They have been able to recognize, for example, crash rates for different categories within the race data. And so that has been between white, Hispanic, Black, American Indian individuals. So I think they have a variety of the data, but I would need to do a little deeper dive into the data to be able to give you a more specific answer. And Professor Eugen is probably much better suited to be able to actually disaggregate the data in some way, shape, or form if he has looked at it at all. But it does appear from the initial publications that I've seen that it's not just one group or one area that is in fact voluntarily giving their data in Colorado.
Thank you,
Mr. Harrington. And Representative Petersburg, I'll give you the last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is to Chair Hornstein, the author of the bill. I'm kind of concerned about the pathway that this has taken. You know, as you presented this bill, you talked about the fact that it, under normal circumstances, it would trigger having to go to judiciary. And so I'm assuming then that you're sending this to Rules Committee to kind of bypass that requirement, which kind of takes away from kind of the transparency and the need for doing that. Especially when I'm not aware that there's anything like this coming out of the Senate and where it's going. So could you help us understand, you know, what the rationale is for bringing this bill forward at this time and what your plan is for how you proceed with it?
Chair Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Petersburg. We hope that this can get a hearing in the Judiciary Committee because, as you can see from the testimony, there is quite a bit of conversation about the data pieces of this, and that's why it's so important. At this point, that is the plan, and we want to make sure that this very important issue is part of the end of session conversation, as I discussed earlier.
Representative Petersburg.
Well, thank you. So I think I heard you say that your plan is to go to Rules Committee and have the Rules Committee send it to Judiciary to have them review it, which I think sounds like a legitimate way for it to go. But if this late state trying to match it up with the Senate could be a problem. So I'm kind of curious to know if you have some discussions with the Senate to try to get this passed into law, or is this just a narrative or end of session?
Representative Chair Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Petersburg. Yes, I'm having conversations with senators, and you know, hopefully this can be, again, part of however the process ends up, that we can get this into law this session.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Chair Hornstein, would you like to wrap up here?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate the conversation and the discussion today. This is a critical issue. We've talked about traffic stops several different times in this committee, and I think it's really very timely. And again, we've had success in other states, and I appreciate very much the testifiers, and especially Commissioner Harrington, for his work on this. And so with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to renew my motion.
With that, Chair Hornstein renews his motion that House File 4818 be referred to the Judiciary Finance Civil Law Committee. Mr. Dodge, would you please take the roll?
Chair Cagle?
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Hornstein?
Aye.
Hornstein, aye. Representative Petersburg?
Petersburg, no.
Petersburg, no. Representative Barr?
Barr, no.
Barr, no. Representative Bernardi? Representative Bernardi.
Bernardi, aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hausman.
Aye.
Hausman, aye. Representative Heinrich.
Heinrich, no.
Heinrich, no. Representative Kosnick.
No.
Kosnick, no. Representative Mason.
Aye.
Mason, aye. Representative Murphy? Representative Murphy? Representative Nelson?
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Olson?
Olson, no.
Olson, no. Representative Richardson?
Richardson, aye.
Richardson, aye. Representative Torkelson?
Torkelson, no.
Torkelson, no. Representative West?
West, no.
West, no. There are 9 ayes and 7 nays.
With 9 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails. Thank you, Chair Hornstein and members. I'll now hand the virtual gavel back to you, Chair Hornstein.
Thank you very much. Representative Cagle, could you if you could just do the next bill, and then I need to just get resituated here. So okay. If you could.
Sounds good. Next on the calendar, you can tell we've been on the floor a lot. Next on the agenda is House File 4599. Representative Heinrich, would you like to present your bill?
And Madam Chair?
Yes.
Before Representative Heinrich starts, I just wanted to give a little bit of background for the committee about why this bill is before us now, if that's okay.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, I first of all want to thank Representative Heinrich for bringing this bill forward. The genesis of this hearing is that prior to markup, Representative Heinrich contacted me and mentioned that he had really had positive conversations with the stakeholders in this bill and had an amendment prepared for the committee. And there were still some concerns out there. We weren't 100% wrapped up. And what I suggested to Representative Heinrich, and I appreciate his indulgence with this, is that we have a hearing so that the committee can be familiar with this, at least as transportation leaders in the Minnesota House. This is a provision in the Senate side. It will be discussed in conference committee. And so wanted to just get a sense of what's going on, particularly if there are ongoing concerns with this, and just hear the bill on an informational basis. And so I wanted to just give the committee that bit of background and perspective. So we can proceed then, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. And Representative Heinrich, if you'd like to introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Chair, Frank Hornstein. So 4599, thank you for the introduction, Mr. Chair. You did a great job there. And I just appreciate the time in the committee. This is a conversation that Concrete and Asphalt and others have been discussing for quite a number of years.
I'm kind of new to the discussion, but it's been a pleasure to work with the people of concrete and asphalt. It's near and dear to my heart because they're living more in the residential and commercial market, not necessarily on 694 or 35W. But the life cycle cost analysis, there were some changes recommended years ago. And what this bill seeks to do is to update the cost analysis and make some of those changes. And we've, I think we've come to a spot where we found some agreement on both sides. And so what I'd like to do, Mr. Chair, I know we don't have a lot of time, but I'd like to just turn it over to the testifiers. I think all of us would be interested to hear from both concrete and asphalt and possibly MnDOT as well, if we have time. And so we can kind of continue to move this conversation down the paved road of concrete and asphalt. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. First up on the agenda, we have Dan Baglio and, or sorry, Joe and Dan Labo. If you guys, who would like to go first?
Madam Chair,
merge you guys together.
Yeah, Matt, yeah, that was you've clearly been on the floor for a long time, so we'll try to be brief. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Bagnoli. I'm a lawyer and lobbyist with Winthrop and Weinstein Law Firm. I represent the Concrete Paving Association of Minnesota, and just wanted to thank Representative Heinrich and yourself, Madam Chair, as co-authors, as well as Representative Kosnick and others, and Representative Hornstein, Chair Pro Tem, I guess. I don't know what you're called as a second chair here, Hornstein, for giving us the opportunity to have this conversation today. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Dan Labo, who's with the Concrete Paving Association. Thank you.
Mr. Labo?
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Dan Labo, and I'm the Director of Engineering Services for the Concrete Paving Association of Minnesota, which represents contractors and material suppliers that produce the vast majority of concrete pavements in Minnesota. Thank you for allowing me to testify at today's hearing. In 2009, the legislature passed the current life cycle analysis law, mandating MnDOT to perform this economic analysis. Though the language was general in nature and was not prescriptive. In 2014, the Office of the Legislative Auditor conducted an audit of MnDOT's cycle cost analysis implementation, which ultimately produced recommendations for MnDOT to improve its process. At that time, MnDOT responded that they would continue to review opportunities to improve the process and that an impending pavement design manual revision was. However, effective resolution recommendations has yet to be implemented systematically.
Mr. Labo, you're kind of cutting out here. Is that me?
No, I think, Madam Chair, there are some technical issues with Mr. Labo's connection here. Maybe we could get back to him.
Yeah, all right.
Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, I may be able to flip him my computer.
Go ahead, try that. I figured you guys were in the same room with the, there you go. Thank you, Mr. Labo, if you could continue.
Yep, turn up the volume here. So here you go. Sorry about technical issue. For example, MnDOT has yet to fully account for agency costs throughout the life cycle cost analysis, such as costs required to produce project designs, mobilize contractors to the project, provide traffic control, and administer construction inspection. Additionally, MnDOT still does not account for significant roadway user costs, such as excess fuel consumption caused by rough pavements and pavement deflection. Passage of this bill would incorporate the Office of the Legislative Auditor's recommendations into law, standardize processes, ensure that economic best practices are followed. It would increase transparency of the pavement selection process, ensure that a Minnesota professional engineer will certify and sign the life cycle cost analysis, and explicitly ensure that MnDOT has the flexibility to exercise engineering judgment in the final pavement selection. For example, MnDOT is allowed to select a project with a higher life cycle cost in this bill, though they simply need to provide the rationale for doing so in writing.
This is warranted to ensure MnDOT has the flexibility on a project where non-economic factors are significant and or legislatively mandated. Additionally, there is broad agreement between both the asphalt and concrete paving industries on this bill, with the principal area of contention being with the use phase excess fuel consumption language included within. However, the local disagreement is less contentious nationally, as Randy West, who is the director of the National Center for Asphalt Technology, wrote earlier this week that their net vision goal for asphalt includes the full life cycle, including the greenhouse gas generated by vehicles during the use phase. He also said, we can't wait any longer to act. We can and we must begin to make the changes we know can move us in the right direction for the sake of future generations. There is broad industry agreement. We need to limit excess fuel consumption and greenhouse gas emissions.
I
just had to pause there. But passage of this bill will also ensure that MnDOT considers the taxpayer's pocketbook when making pavement selection decisions. And this bill represents a common sense approach to save taxpayer dollars at the fuel pump. To that end, the excess fuel consumption language is critical to reduce excess fuel cost to taxpayers and reduce excess CO2 emissions into our atmosphere. And finally, we need to consider the full use phase impacts of our transportation decisions. And when we do so, long life fixes are frequently the best way to minimize impacts to traffic, reduce bottom line costs to the taxpayers, and to minimize the total CO2 emitted into the environment. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I stand ready for questions.
Thank you. Next up, we have Abby Breidick from the Minnesota Asphalt Pavement Association. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, hello. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Abby Breidick, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Asphalt Pavement Association. Thank you to the chairs for hearing this bill and allowing us all to discuss this topic today. So as was said by the previous map, it does share many of the same concerns as CPAM regarding the slow action or response to some of the recommendations from the 2014 OLA report on pavement selection. We would welcome more transparency of decision-making and especially an opportunity to weigh in on the LCCA analysis at a time where collaboration between the industries and MnDOT could occur. There's one section, as mentioned, that we find very problematic in the current language, and that is the excess fuel calculation. While we strongly agree, and as was quoted, our national representative was quoted, we agree that it is very important to assess the impact of that carbon emissions have on the road paving process and the life cycle. However, we believe this may be more effectively done through the EPD process or environmental product declaration process, which is being discussed at MnDOT and is also the subject of the current House Buy Clean proposal included in the House Energy Bill. The fuel consumption language in this bill will not provide a meaningful assessment and is not based on peer-reviewed research. The Concrete Sustainability Hub at MIT has for several years pushed the idea that a flexible pavement, which is asphalt, creates a system where the tire is continuously rolling uphill out of a deflection basin. This is a calculated concept. There have been no real-life rolling resistance studies done that have verified that this energy loss actually occurs. However, there are also studies that have shown that smoother pavements like asphalt actually contribute to better fuel economy. Understanding the impacts of pavement smoothness and the related fuel savings and greenhouse gas reduction, as well as with rigidity, needs more study. Therefore, if any of this language were to be taken in conference committee, we request that the excess fuel calculation language in subdivision 2A be dropped. And I think, not to speak for MnDOT, but we have collaborated with them on the review and they agree that that more study could be done on this section. If this bill language doesn't move forward this year, MAPA would be happy to participate in a working group to come up with a consensus approach to the best values in the LCCA process. What would also be helpful but isn't included in this bill is user cost delays during construction, end of life salvage value, which is very important to our industry as asphalt is 100% recyclable, and an audit of the accuracy of previous LCCAs compared to actual results. It would be good to see if the LCCA predictions are truly providing the best value to the Minnesota taxpayer. Thank you for considering this bill and for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Breidick. Last on for the testifiers is Nancy Dobenberger, the interim commissioner for MnDOT. Welcome to the committee. If you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Dobenberger, and I am the interim commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Thank you for the opportunity to share our agency's perspective on House File 4599. I also have my colleague, Kurt Turgeon, MnDOT's pavement engineer, here with us for assistance if needed with technical questions. MnDOT has concerns with the changes to our process for pavement life cycle cost analysis, or LCCA as we refer to it, that are proposed in the bill. MnDOT's current LCCA process was developed over many years using experience gained from past methods and the review of other state DOT processes, the Federal Highway Administration guidance, and academic papers, along with input from industry stakeholders. The current LCCA process, based on substantial research and stakeholder input, allows MnDOT district's discretion to use an alternate bid process and select pavement types based on factors like constructability, pavement type continuity, traffic control issues, and the effect on businesses. Also, pavement management surveys are completed every year to determine deterioration curves and associated life of fixed types. And destructive and non-destructive testing is used to refine the design and pavement fixed types, including core sampling and performing borings, ground penetrating radar, LIDAR, infrared imaging, et cetera. And districts have the discretion to use the alternate bid process if the results are within 10% within the life cycle cost analysis. So our recommendation is for the legislature to direct the department to work with stakeholders to study issues related to pavement selection, especially related to using an excess fuel consumption calculation. And study that in depth with our industry partners and report back to the legislature with consensus recommendations for changes to this process. If changes are made to the LCCA process, they should only apply to projects programmed beyond July 1st of 2024 in our State Transportation Improvement Program. Thank you for allowing me to testify on this bill. I will stand for questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Give me a second here. All right, seeing none, Representative Heinrich, would you like any final comments?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I just want to thank the testifiers. It was interesting for me to hear from MnDOT, Ms. Dernberger. I apologize if I messed that up.
Dobenberger.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate that. I do have one question for the MnDOT testifier, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
We're in an informational hearing, so I guess that's fine.
We are running short for two more bills, however.
Okay, sounds good. Well, maybe we can chat offline. I'm just interested in a few more, kind of perked my ears on a few things that you mentioned. But thank you for the time again, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifiers, Abby Bryduck and Joe Bignali and Dan LeBeau, especially. Thanks so much for the time today.
Thank you, Representative Heinrich. All right, Chair Hornstein, would you like your gavel back?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and just also thank you, Representative Heinrich, and I think some really good ideas came forward out of this just 15 minutes we had on this bill, and I will be visiting with you, Representative Heinrich, to discuss some next steps. But we now have a pair of bills from Representative Houseman, who just while I have the opportunity, want to thank you, Representative Houseman, for so many incredible years of service. This is, I think, maybe your last bill hearing in your career. And so we really just appreciate your mentorship and you've been a stalwart on transportation. I think it's very fitting that that we start with a bill that I know you are very passionate about. You know, you have been really the leader in the legislature, House and Senate, over so many years on the issue of passenger rail. And so if you could let us know a little bit about House File 3160, and then we'll have your testifiers, as this is a bill that an idea and concept that you've put forward recently and certainly deserves a hearing and conversation as we end the legislative session. Representative Hausman.
Thank you. And I'm going to save all the time for the testifiers because we have two bills and I know there are a number of testifiers. So I will just let them proceed. The first one is if you're saying we're doing passenger rail first, which is all aboard Minnesota.
Yeah, House File 3160, we're hearing on an informational basis. And so the first testifier is Mr. Brian Nelson. And as you mentioned, Chair Hausman, he is with an organization called All Aboard Minnesota. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Nelson. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Brian Nelson, and I represent All Aboard Minnesota, which is a nonprofit citizen advocacy organization dedicated to the development of fast, comfortable, and frequent intercity passenger train services within the state of Minnesota and connecting us to the upper Midwest. I'm here to testify today in favor of House File 3160, which would provide $26 million to help build out the state rail passenger plan. You should have all received our one-page fact sheet, our regional passenger rail map, and letters in your committee packets. Mr. Howe, if you would be so kind as to screen share the map that we provided, I would very much appreciate it. House File 3160 would fund two key routes that would connect outstate Minnesota communities to regional and metropolitan centers. These routes would allow the flow of dollars and people to and from these communities that are currently largely only accessible by automobile. On the map that we provided, which is coming up right now, there are these two key routes, and I'll outline them for you right now. Last year, the legislature provided funding to complete the second daily train between the Twin Cities, Milwaukee, and Chicago. House File 3160 would extend this route from the Twin Cities to St. Cloud and Fargo-Moorhead, serving intermediate stops on a daytime schedule. Amtrak's long-distance Empire Builder passenger train serves this line late at night westbound and very early in the morning eastbound. House File 3160 would also provide funding for a study for new passenger rail service between the Twin Cities, Northfield, Owatonna, Albert Lea, Des Moines, and Kansas City. These routes were chosen because they offer the most potential as defined by ridership and population served, infrastructure already in place with freight railroads, existing private investment by freight railroads, and cost recovery and fare box recovery. Finally, 3160 would also allow MnDOT to study a dedicated mainline, passenger mainline between Minneapolis and St. Paul downtowns, something railroads are likely to ask for because of capacity constraints and demands. It would also provide funding to study a light maintenance facility to service these new routes and the forthcoming Northern Lights Express service from the Twin Cities to Duluth. So what would be the benefits to Minnesota of these additional passenger rail routes? These routes would provide new or expanded rail service to more than 30 Minnesota communities, as defined by 25 miles of these routes, and would serve about 70% of the state's population, and that excludes the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Passenger rail provides a mobility option for a variety of audiences that either cannot or don't want to drive or fly. That includes millennials, elderly, college students, families, and many more. Winter driving conditions can be treacherous along the I-94 and I-35 corridors, which these routes parallel, in winter, especially for elderly already hesitant to drive in these conditions. Even in some of the worst conditions, the trains would still be running. The route south from the Twin Cities to Northfield, Des Moines, Kansas City would offer a direct connection for Minnesota to Amtrak trains serving St. Louis, Denver, cities in Texas, Phoenix, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. Currently, passengers must first connect to these services in Chicago, so this would be a tremendous time saving. These two routes would not just move Minnesotans to their destinations. People from Fargo, Des Moines, Omaha, Denver, and Kansas City could travel to our state easily, bringing with them dollars to spend in our communities. Typically, for every $1 invested in passenger rail service, $3 are returned to the communities they serve, mainly through tourist spending. This is especially important for small and medium-sized communities throughout the state. We estimate that Union Pacific, which owns the line south from the Twin Cities through Albert Lea and Des Moines, Kansas City, has spent about $300 million on track and signal improvements on this route. We estimate that Burlington Northern Santa Fe has spent at least $325 million on the Twin Cities to Fargo route. This provides a tremendous discount to the state of Minnesota to expand passenger rail service on these routes. Other states have made significant investments and expanded passenger rail in a bipartisan fashion and have experienced high ridership numbers in states like Michigan, Illinois, Wisconsin, Virginia, Missouri, and North Carolina. Expanded and new passenger rail provides economic competitiveness with these other states I have mentioned. Grants are now available in the Jobs and Infrastructure Acts passed by Congress, and these states are already going after those grants. Minnesota should act now to receive these grants. Passenger rail provides 45% more energy efficiency than automobiles and produces up to 83% fewer greenhouse gas emissions than driving. It would take a significant amount of cars off the I-94 and I-35 corridors. Finally, I'd really like to emphasize that there is widespread support from communities in Minnesota that want new and expanded passenger rail service. Cities such as Anoka, Little Falls, Staples, Brainerd, Wadena, St. Paul, Red Wing, Winona, and La Crescent have recently passed city resolutions asking that the state fund more passenger rail, citing economic and mobility benefits for their cities and residents. And the last thing that I'd like to emphasize is that long-distance passenger rail, which is what we're talking about here, is a completely different product and service than light rail or commuter rail. Amtrak is one of the most efficient passenger rail providers in the world, and pre-COVID, Amtrak cited a 90% fare box recovery ratio. So I'd really like to emphasize that long-distance passenger rail is a completely different product and service. Finally, I'd like to thank Representative Hausman for authoring this legislation, Chair Hornstein, and the committee for hearing this bill today. And as I understand it, Susie Nikazian from the Northfield City Council has some additional testifiers to talk about support in that region. Thank you for your time, and I stand for any questions.
You're muted, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nelson, for that excellent testimony. And my understanding is that we have three additional testifiers and that Ms. Nikazian and Mr. Crome are available for questions. Is that your understanding also, Council Member? Thank you. And Council Member, while I see you on the call, I do want to thank you for being such a staunch advocate of passenger rail and for helping to arrange this hearing. So thank you, Council Member, for your advocacy over many years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Our first testifier is Bill, and I hope I'm pronouncing your name. Please correct me if I don't pronounce your last name correctly. Drost, Mayor of the City of Rosemont. I've had an opportunity to go to several meetings on transportation issues in Rosemont, so I know that there's a lot going on there. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I believe Mayor Drost may not be here. Councilmember Nikazian, can you confirm? She indicated she would speak in his place.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm afraid Mayor Drosty of the city of, I'm sorry, by any name, he's a great leader.
The city of Rosemont is one of the 41 regional stakeholders that have unanimously endorsed the Albert Lea corridor. I think he has a conflict for this morning and asked me to speak in his behalf.
Okay, good. Sorry, I didn't know that. Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much. Well, building on what the All Aboard representative has said, I'd like to endorse 3160 and a shout out to Representative Houseman, who for all these years has been tantamount to that children's story of the little engine that could. I think I can. The time has come for Minnesota to think about regional passenger rail and to utilize this very pragmatic way to reintroduce regional transit to greater Minnesota. I speak in support from Northfield, which is right on the border of the Met Council. And for my brothers and sisters south of the line, we have no regional transit options. And we have an existing rail network that would meet those needs in a double way, which I'll say. So I'll be speaking primarily in support of the Albert Lea corridor, which is one of the phase one corridors identified in Representative Hausman's bill. That said, of all the corridors, it's the most significant for the benefit that it brings to all the corridors. It is also a corridor that utilizes signaled mainline rail infrastructure. It's ready for passenger rail almost right now. Class 3 and 4 track primarily. We need a study to take a look at that corridor to see specifically what's needed. But the significance of the corridor is that it uses signaled mainline infrastructure to reconnect southern Minnesota to both Minneapolis Target Field Station and St. Paul Union Depot. And it potentially uses a stretch of track that goes right under the busway that carries the Twin Cities, the bridge that carries the Twin Cities busway, another 60,000 students. And I'll just pause for a second. I will send in follow-up to this hearing a map that we created that shows the overlay of the approved state phase one corridors in our statewide rail plan and the connections that they afford to all 17 private colleges in Minnesota, 4 of the 5 campuses of the University of Minnesota, all 7 colleges of the state MinState network, and I count 23 vocational and community colleges around the state. So we're talking passenger rail, but that piece of the connection that it affords for our post-secondary institutions is crucial, and I will send a map to follow up. So we are reconnecting southern Minnesota to the metro. We're connecting the metro. We're introducing a reasonable, regional, reliable source of transportation to college and education for students without the benefit of cars. And the last benefit of this corridor is that it opens the way, as Mr. Nelson has said, for the reintroduction of interstate passenger rail service on the same corridor, which continues south of our state line to Des Moines and Kansas City, both cities that are very eager to support this corridor. I've traveled the whole thing and met with all the mayors. So, but for Minnesota, we cannot move forward in connecting Minnesota back to the Amtrak. I don't know if I can share my screen, Mr. Howe, but to move forward with, I don't know, Mr. Howe, if it's possible to share my screen to show the implications of our line for the Amtrak, the National Amtrak system. Basically, what we do here is you'll see this map where I've added our line to the south, creates a shortcut, if you will, between the American West and Southwest in Minnesota, making it possible for all those state passengers to come into the state without having to go by way of Chicago, spend the night, and wait for a train to come back. This is of vast significance for our state tourism, for everything about our state, and is also a benefit to the Amtrak network. We need to study this corridor to move that forward. And to study the corridor, we've asked for $500,000. MnDOT has previously requested. It has to be general funds, so some amendment would be needed, I believe, I'm told by the revisor's office, to this bill as worded, because studies have to come from general funds, obviously. But I'm grateful for this chance to talk about the line, and it's just exceptional significance for our statewide rail network and for our state strategic location in the national passenger rail revolution that is underway in the rest of the country. So thank you for your time, Mr. Chair.
We have a couple of local testifiers. Is that right?
Yes.
We have one more building.
Thank you, Councilmember Nikasian.
Thank you.
Our next testifier is Nort Johnson. He's the president and CEO of the Faribault Area Chamber of Commerce and Tourism.
Thank you. First, good morning. And thank you, everybody on the call here, for your commitments to Minnesota and your public service. I served 10 years as an elected official. And since then, I've been working beside and with government on a wide array of projects and policies for 16 years. It's not easy, your work, but it's important. So again, thank you. Regarding funding of the study for the regional passenger rail corridor, we think it's important to our community to give this opportunity a meaningful investigation for these reasons. The support the rail line could give to our historic business district as both a tourism destination and business center. The rail, by the way, it goes right adjacent to our historic district in Faribault. And if you weren't aware, it's the second largest district in the state of Minnesota, outside of St. Paul. So it's you and us doing our historic preservation work for the state. This could definitely be an enhancement for that. These businesses in our district right now have been heavily invested in both in all three areas, including the arts, dining, and events amenities. Millions of dollars have been put into that downtown, and there are millions of more dollars slated to be invested in this historic district, both to preserve it and to provide additional economic engines in our town. Additional support from train riders would certainly be an advantage to the continued development in these preservation efforts. Economic development efforts could also be enhanced by passenger rail, as our diverse workforce needs could be better served with rail transportation, not just from the metro, but from southern interstate connections, in the same way the metro and other connections in other states enhance their ability to attract and retain employees. Certainly a passenger rail option could also serve our residents through their travel needs to the Twin Cities and south as well. So I'm saying please give every consideration for the investment in the study that could enhance Rice County and Minnesota's transportation future. We truly want to know if this is going to work, and that's what this investment is about. Let's give this a very good look to understand if it's feasible. If it is, we're in. So thank you for your time.
Great.
Thank you so much, Mr. Johnson. And then our final testifier is Galen Malecha, a Rice County Commissioner. And again, I apologize if I mispronounced the name.
You got it. It's all good. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for having us here today. Thank you to all the elected officials. As an elected official, I know your job is not easy, but thank you for serving the great people of the state of Minnesota. Just quickly, a University of Minnesota study of Greater Minnesota commuting patterns reported that 57% of Rice County's low, middle, and high-income employed residents commute out of our county to work, the majority of them going to Hennepin and Ramsey. And yet our county, like most Greater Minnesota, is underserved by regional transit options. Meanwhile, we have a regional rail line that runs right through the center of our county and through the commercial centers of most populated cities. The rail lines connect to St. Paul Union Depot and to Minneapolis Target Field Station on a stretch of rail line that runs right under the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. The project has robust grassroots support in Rice County, and not just Rice County. Councillor Nikasian and myself spent a good year going to other city council meetings and other county meetings, gaining this grassroots support. There was 40 communities, counties, and colleges in southern Minnesota that are supporting this project. It makes plain common sense to study the existing rail line to reconnect Rice County and many other counties in southern Minnesota to Greater Minnesota to the metro. On behalf of Rice County Board, which voted unanimously to support the passenger rail designation of the Albert Lea Passenger Rail Corridor, we would like to thank you for your opportunity of affording us time before you today. And I guess we'll stand for questions at this point.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I failed
and
to.
Mr. Chair, I think we probably, because we have one more bill, I should just clarify to committee members, this is for information only. This bill actually was referred to the Capital Investment Committee, and they actually do have some general fund money available to them. So I have been continuing to work with that committee, but we wanted to be sure that Transportation Committee members just were aware of the issue and the policies. But I'm thinking we have one more bill, and so perhaps we, I think we are time bound here.
Yeah, and thank you, Representative Hausman, and thank you for all the testifiers. Members, we do have until 10:30. So,
if there is a question or two,
we can take them. But you are correct, Chair Hausman. We should move along. But if the commissioner could, I failed to ask you to state your name for the record, so I have that correctly. We can do that.
Sure, Galen Malika, Rice County Commissioner.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Malika.
Thank you. You bet.
And I want to thank everybody for testifying, and this is an exciting project, and we look forward to working with you as this moves forward. Okay, Representative Hausman, you have our last bill, and then we have kind of an informational session on the dedicated funds work that was done in the interim and earlier this session. And those are our last two items on the agenda this morning. So the next one, Representative Hausman, again, on an informational basis, House File 3718. This is very interesting, members, because earlier, just last month in Chair Mason's committee, we had an informational hearing on the elected Met Council bill that I'm advancing. And now Representative Hausman also has a bill around governance as it relates to transit. And so this one was actually referred to our committee. And I think there is, whether it's specifically around the Met Council or the bill we're about to hear, I think there's a growing sense that we need to have reform of governance when it comes to transit. And so this is another idea, and I wanted to hear it. Representative Hausman, so if you could introduce it, and then we'll take public testimony.
And I give full credit to the citizens who have been working on this, the Citizen Advocates for Regional Transit, and they will help you understand their strong commitment to having a good system that works for the entire metropolitan region. So Citizen Advocates for Regional Transit, CART, and I will save all the time for their testimony.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. And I would just ask that the testifiers be as succinct as possible again because of our time constraints. But I do appreciate your work in this bill. And our first testifier is James Schlater, who is with the CART organization. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Jim Shuttler,
I am bad with names this morning. I apologize.
It's not the first time, I guarantee you that. As mentioned, I'm an associate of CART, Citizen Advocates for Regional Transit. It's a small group of mostly retired professionals with a wide range of professional experience in civil engineering, project management and operations, transportation management, and among others. Mr. Chairman, House File 3718 addresses a very big subject, clearly the future of public transit in the metro area. And this, in turn, has a lot to do with the future success of the metro area. Transit is essential. Now, we've spent many years observing and studying this subject. We believe the legislature needs to answer two clear questions. Number one, will we continue to focus transit investments on getting people to the two downtowns and ignoring the transit needs of 80% of the public who rarely go downtown? And two, will we continue with the ineffective and wasteful separation of transit development between the counties and the Metropolitan Council, which has led to enormous delays and cost overruns, and which promises nothing but the same if no changes are made? Now, House File 3718 answers these two questions and identifies solutions. Keep in mind that it's not just people going downtown who need public transit. There are a lot of people in every neighborhood of every city who need or would prefer public transit. If we are going to tax everyone in the transit taxing district, shouldn't we have appropriate transit service in the whole transit taxing district? And shouldn't we make it possible for transit riders to get to where they want to go, even if it is not downtown? The legislature must address these issues. We believe House File 3718 can serve first as a roadmap for your deliberative process, and second, perhaps as the framework for the solution that you need. The bill is intended to do two fundamental things. Number one, restructure governance of transit in accordance with project management best practices. That means to place full responsibility and accountability for planning, designing, funding, implementing, and operating of the Metropolitan Transit System in the hands of the Metropolitan Council. While, this is really important, assuring the ongoing participation of the municipalities and counties affected through the comprehensive planning process, which is a much deeper process. We call this unified transit governance. And the second item is to set a new goal for the Metropolitan Transit System, which is very simply to enable anyone in the transit taxing district to reach any other location in the district in a reasonable amount of time. We call this universal transit mobility. Now, in regard to that point, we have to remember we are no longer a region of two downtowns. We are a region with dozens of downtowns and myriad other destinations. New ways of shopping, working, studying, and so forth need to be considered. It is time to broaden the focus of public transit investments. There are a lot of people who can't drive or shouldn't drive or can't afford to drive or don't want to endure hours of traffic congestion or frankly prefer and want to ride a dependable transit system that safely gets them from where they are to where they want to go. Universal transit mobility will require networks of LRT, BRT, buses, shuttles, transit on demand, ride hailing, autonomous vehicles perhaps, each employed where they make the most sense, and this is key, operated together as a system. Now, in regard to the first objective here on governance, the bifurcation of rail transit planning between the counties and the Met Council has been a very expensive, time-wasting, real-world demonstration of how not to build a regional transit network. It should not surprise that only the wealthiest county has accomplished much, and the other counties have gone their separate ways. What regional transit planning we have is piecemeal at best. And counties are simply unprepared to make decisions for their neighbors. Promises and assurances regarding the alignment are made that cannot be supported in the real world of construction and operation. Instead, counties and municipalities need first to study the transit needs of their residents and advocate for them through their comprehensive planning. A regional agency is required that can knit together these local needs and transform them into regional patterns of movement that dictate the appropriate modes of transit and routes. Mr. Chairman, American business learned long ago that you must have responsibility and accountability for major projects. You can't have each department going off and doing what it feels like. Here, especially at the metropolitan scale, you must have clear objectives from the legislature and clear lines of authority for getting it done. If you want more problems like Southwest, Botno, Riverview, North Star, keep doing the same. But in our view, it's a formula for disaster. So just to summarize, we need public transit. It serves many purposes. It is fundamental to the long-term sustainability of this metropolitan area. So it is time for the legislature to rethink what we need public transit to do in the metropolitan area, to recognize that the world has changed. Public transit must be designed for the 21st century. It needs to provide both local service and long-distance service in a seamless regional system. And the legislature needs to reform metropolitan transit legislation, giving a mandate to the one agency with a demonstrated ability to put together metropolitan scale services with the ongoing participation of the municipalities and counties affected. So we see House File 3718 as a real roadmap for the legislature. We hope it can be used for that to rethink and reform how public transit should be done in the metropolitan area. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I believe we have one other member of CART, Matt Hollinshead, who would like to share a few words with you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And Mr. Hollinshead, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matthews Hollinshead. I am one of two transit modal representatives on the Transportation Advisory Board, or the TAB, of the Metropolitan Council of the Twin Cities. I am not representing that board today. These are my personal remarks. I support House File 3718 because it is, in essence, an equal rights amendment for non-drivers and pedestrians. By enabling anyone in the transit taxing district to reach any location in the TTD in a reasonable amount of time without a car. Our current normal, quote unquote, is warped. In a book called The Big Roads by Earl Swift, he notes that the father of the Appalachian Trail, the longest pedestrian right-of-way in North America, was also the father of the concept of the limited access roadway, a paradigm that has made life on foot in the metropolitan area almost impossible. Also in the book, Swift notes that the first person ever granted a PhD in traffic engineering from Harvard, no less, was also the father of jaywalking, which from the 1920s threw pedestrians off our streets and roads, forcing them to corners in order to cross a street. There is hardly a single building of any type in America today that is not directly accessible by motor vehicle in a reasonable amount of time. But on foot, the vast majority of our built environment is not accessible in a reasonable amount of time. Parity between pedestrian and motor vehicle access requires a single system of regional transit with efficiency as a top priority, possible only with unified governance. What we have instead is a grab bag of disparate modes and lines planned by metro counties that will never get us to reasonable regional pedestrian access, because counties are not constitutional creatures of the federal government, and it is the federal government that funds what we call transitways to be built. We need to designate a state agency as planner, builder, and operator of metro-wide regional transit. It is the state, not counties, that have direct constitutional representation in Washington, D.C., our two senators and eight members of Congress. It should be their duty as state representatives to federal funders and regulators to address and overcome the challenges we face in working with freight railroads, for example, entities that are also regulated not locally or regionally, but rather federally in Washington, D.C. The alternatives for designation are MnDOT or the Metropolitan Council, both state agencies with transportation missions. But there is a big difference between those missions. MnDOT has little to do with rail and nothing to do with metropolitan transit. By contrast, Metropolitan Council plans, builds, and operates most metropolitan transit. Unfortunately, the one form of transit it does not plan, transitways, is also the one form of transit most lacking in the Metropolitan Council's performance of its mission, regional planning and services. That must and should change. Please support House File 3718 for the sake of sanity, of health, of the climate, of our children and descendants, and of the future of humanity. Give pedestrians back the rights we had a century ago before traffic engineers took them away. And before I sign off here, I would like to thank Alice Hausman for her years of service and for this bill. She indeed has been a champion like no other. Thank you so much, Representative Hausman.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hollinshead. Thank you for the history perspective, and that was very interesting. And also I concur with your kind comments about Chair Hausman. Has been such an inspiration to so many of us. Our last testifier on this bill is Ryan Timlin, and Mr. Timlin is the president of the ATU 1005. And so, Mr. Timlin, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Ryan Timlin, my name, R-Y-A-N, last name T-I-M-L-I-N. I am, as the chair stated, I am the president of Amalgamated Transit Union Local 1005. We represent 2,000 transit workers throughout the state of Minnesota. I do want to state first, before I get into the majority of my comment, that ATU Local 1005 and the ATU International agree wholeheartedly with expansion of transit systems in a more effective way. I want to make that clear. We do not disagree with that. And we also do, as Mr. Hornstein, we, as ATU 1005, we have had, you know, many issues with the Metropolitan Council, and I don't want to make it sound like the Metropolitan Council has been running smoothly and there's no problems there. One thing I would like to point out, though, as a part of the Metropolitan Council is Metro Transit, and most of our workforce is represented at Metro Transit. That's the largest chunk of our employees. We represent all the frontline employees that make Metro Transit work. And with this, I'd just like to say, with the problems of the council, Metro Transit, even with the problems of the council, has had a history of being pretty efficient with its funds, unlike many of the other operators throughout, transit operators throughout the local area or the country. You know, a lot of that goes, not all of it, I'm not gonna say a lot of it goes many different areas. Equipment is not cheap. I can tell you that, just to give an example, electric bus is over $1 million. But just back to the statement, too often, a lot in these discussions with the expansion of this type of service, which we agree with, too often it's overlooked the workforces that help maintain and operate. But not only that, the equipment, they maintain the equipment, and those who provide the services such as transit information or customer service, which we represent, overlooked. And many of the other agencies outside of Metro Transit, not a lot of that money comes down to those workforces. Too often in gig economies, such like rideshare, which I'm not saying you guys are looking at Uber or Lyft, but just to give it a good example, too often in these situations, that workforce is extremely exploited. They do not receive health care. They're pushed and pushed and pushed to produce money without many breaks or time off to let the body recover. As a former driver, you may think you're just sitting there, but sitting there trying to get the bus or the train from point A to point B is very taxing sitting there. And then your hope that you get time out of the seat to give the body a break. Not only that, a lot of times, such in rideshare situations, the costs are pushed off onto the workforce. They get listed as independent contractors. We want to raise this situation so that not only is a good service provided, but good jobs within the system. And that is one thing that Metro Transit, along because of ATU, has been able to provide, is that type of situation. And that's what I'm here to speak about today. Oh, the other thing I would like to add, you know, we are open to different ideas of moving people around. We're not opposed to that. But just another concern to raise is such as the idea of autonomous vehicles. One of the key things that is a factor in protecting riders and making sure they're safe in, you know, Metro Transit, as you've seen in the last week, we've had a couple of major issues happen, but it was our operators who helped do what they could the best to protect that those riders. In autonomous vehicles, if you do not have somebody there, there's not that protection that exists to make sure the riders are getting from point A to point B safely. It is the courageous work that our members face daily in these safety situations that helps those passengers get to where they need to go. And that's why I'm speaking here today. I'm hoping that this these ideas I've raised stay within the minds of you all as this bill goes forward, that this workforce needs to be thought about in this process to make sure that good jobs can be built throughout these areas. And one thing HU has worked very hard on, and Metro Transit, one positive thing I can say the Metro Transit has worked in recent years with us on, is an apprenticeship program to making sure operations and maintenance, we have a well-trained workforce who knows exactly what they're dealing with this equipment, to make sure it's maintained properly. And that from every aspect of it is maintained properly, not only from the maintenance side, but even on the operation side, we have apprenticeship programs for the operators to make sure that they can get through these very tough, isolating job and view this as career. And that's what I hope you all view these jobs as too, that these are careers. The more you have people behind the wheel and maintaining and doing the transit information services, the more that they do that, the more skilled they become, and the more professional it is, the system is operated. And that is one thing we strive to do at ATU. So
thank you so much.
Just ending on those points. Thank you all very much.
Thank you so much for mentioning that, Mr. Timlin. And I, while you're here, I just want to thank you as a transit rider. I don't drive myself. You are frontline workers. You did heroic work and continue to do heroic work. This pandemic is not over. And, you know, so I have appreciated so much your union, your work, the operators, those who have really been on the front lines now for over 2 years. Mm-hmm. So thank you from the bottom of my heart, and thank you for your testimony. Any closing comments, Chair Hausman, and we'll get to our last agenda.
Yes, just a thank you to all of the people you heard from today. All Board Minnesota, I've had this long working relationship and this partnership. The Citizen Advocates for Regional Transit have inspired me. Ms. Nukasian, who came today and has continued to inform me, and she organizes other local officials in their areas. I have been inspired by these citizens. You heard from many of them today, who challenge us to rethink how we provide transportation choices. So thank you to all of you. I continue to look forward to a partnership as we work together.
And thank you again, Chair Hausman, for all of your work and service, and I think really reminding us about the vision that we need to carry forward in our work long term as well as in the moment. So thank you so much, Representative Hausman. All right, members, we have one last item here, and it's an important one. As part of the omnibus transportation bill last year, a dedicated funds expenditures task force was created. Now, that task force met fairly frequently in fall and right on up to including the beginning of the legislative session. I want to really thank Representative Petersburg for co-chairing this committee along with Senator Dibble. They did an incredible job. There was a lot of preparation that had to go into every one of our meetings. We met frequently. We learned a lot about the history and constitutional issues around how particularly the gas tax is applied, the Highway User Trust Distribution Fund, what we as a legislature need to be responsible for, what changes, if any, are needed in terms of the uses of that funding. And so I wanted to just spend here the last few minutes of our hearing with an update or a summary of that fund report that MnDOT had really helped to create. So we have Craig Gustafson from MnDOT with us. Mr. Gustafson will give a brief update. I also want to thank another member of that task force. I served on it as well. Representative Elkins did stellar work, really was an active participant and made a lot of very helpful contributions. So thank you, Representative Elkins. So Mr. Gustafson, if you could just provide a very brief summary, and this may be one where we have a couple of member questions, so I want to leave time for that as well. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Gustafson. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Craig Gustafson. I'm Chief Counsel at MnDOT. I'm really happy to be here this morning to talk about the work that the Dedicated Fund Expenditures Task Force did last fall. As you mentioned,
We thank the leadership of Senator Dibble and Representative Petersburg for chairing, co-chairing the task force. And I think we had some great discussions and learned a lot. Next slide, please. As you can see here on this slide, the task force was created last first special session. And the statement there that the dedicated task force is established to review and make recommendations regarding the permissible uses of expenditures from the Trunk Highway Fund and the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund is exactly what we did as a group. The background, and Representative Hornstein mentioned this a little bit, was through negotiations last year. And it's kind of started with Senator Newman's proposal to move a significant number of offices at MnDOT and other functions into the general fund. And you'll see later in my presentation which ones actually were moved. But this was kind of a compromise to establish this task force and talk about things and come back this session and review what the task force did. Next slide, please. Okay, here's the basis of this whole conversation. Constitution, Minnesota Constitution, Article 14, Sections 2 and 6, provides for the trunk highway system, which will should be constructed, improved, and maintained as public highways by the state. And in Section 6 of that same article, it creates the Trunk Highway Fund, which is used specifically for those activities in Section 2, which you go back to as construction, improvements, and maintenance of that trunk highway system. The Supreme Court has addressed this constitutional provision several times over the years. That quote on the bottom is from a case called Minneapolis Gas Company versus Zimmerman, which was decided in 1958. And I'll just read that quote from the Supreme Court. It would be unreasonable to hold that the proceeds of the highway fund may not be expended for whatever is reasonably necessary to the complete accomplishment of all the basic purposes for which a highway exists. And that's consistent with the other cases that the Supreme Court has decided in this area. They take a very broad view of Article 14 of the Constitution. Next slide, please. Here's our task force members. As you can see, four senators, four representatives, a bipartisan group co-chaired by Representative Petersburg and Senator Dibble. Also on the task force was our commissioner at the time, Margaret Anderson Kelleher, and representatives from MMB, DPS, and the Office of the Attorney General. And I'd also like to mention the staff support. We had significant staff support for the task force activities by MnDOT, in particular, Jen Parsley and Matt Shands from our office provided a ton of work and support to the task force. And your House research analyst, Matt Burris, was integral in doing the work of the task force, as was Lexi Stangle from Senate Counsel's office. The task force actually met 15 times, and then we had a subcommittee established to talk about the definition of highway purposes, and that subcommittee met three times. So a significant number of meetings over the last several months, from about August of 21 until March of this year. Next slide, please. First phase that the task force undertook was gathering information. We had House, Senate, and agency staff provide background details on funding, existing reporting requirements, and how we spend the money from the Trunk Highway Fund. We had two constitutional law scholars in, Professor David Schultz from Hamline and Professor Fred Morrison from the University of Minnesota. And they did presentations on the constitutional language and precedent and statutory interpretation. A key takeaway there was that the courts have provided considerable deference to the legislature when they're interpreting this article of the Constitution and considerable deference to the agency's interpretation. So the legislature really has a lot of flexibility in determining how to spend this money, and the courts will show that deference. We also had the ASHTO, Director of Policy and Government Relations, Jung Lee, come in and talk about how other states deal with this issue. And we found out that really every other state has significant restrictions on spending of transportation dollars, except for the state of Alaska. That was the one exception. Otherwise, there's a lot of states that put this money into some type of lockbox or have constitutional restrictions on how transportation funding is eligible to be spent. Next slide, please. Some takeaways from the task force. We really dug into the question of highway purpose. And when I talk about highway purpose, I go back to that constitutional provision of construction, maintenance, and improvement of the trunk highway system. And we really talked about that a lot and discussed whether we needed a definition of that in statutes. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. But we assembled a report, and we had multiple draft reports that are now in that one report. And it's over 200 pages. It's a great resource, I think, when we look at this issue again in the future, even decades from now, when future legislators look at this issue, I think this will be a great archive of the conversations that happened at the task force. And I would guess that this is the most extensive conversation that we've ever undertaken in state history relating to the trunk highway system and the constitutional provisions that govern it. Next slide. Some conclusions. You'll see there, while the task force found both points of consensus and disagreement in addressing the question, it did not formally adopt any specific findings or recommendations. However, I think that everyone agreed that the conversation should continue, and we should look at how the legislative and executive branch collaborates and partners on this and reviews all these expenditures to make sure we're complying with all laws and the Constitution. The report really reflects that 6 months of thoughtful consideration of the issue. Next slide, please. Here's our task force website. This is where you go if you want to read the full report, if you want to see the meeting minutes, any of the presentations that we had for the task force. That's all right there. If you go to MnDOT's website and click on A to Z and go to D for Dedicated Funds Expenditure Task Force, that's all right there. If you have any trouble accessing any of the materials, don't hesitate to reach out to us at MnDOT and we'll direct you to the right place. So that's our website. Next slide, please. And these are the restrictions that I mentioned before that were passed in 2021 in the first special session. One thing to note about these, it says they're effective July 1st, 2025. That's actually the statutory provision. The similar restrictions were actually put in a rider in the budget bill. So we've actually already implemented these restrictions at MnDOT and are working from that those parameters right now. One other thing to note, when we add restrictions like this in statute or session law, it does not mean that these are unconstitutional uses of the trunk highway fund. It's simply a legislative preference to move certain activities into the general fund to free up some of the trunk highway fund for other activities such as, you know, road projects, bridge projects, and those kind of bread and butter activities that MnDOT undertakes. So that there's no implication that, for example, rent and utility expenses for MnDOT's central office building is an unconstitutional expenditure of trunk highway funds.
Mr. Gustafson, yes. If you could wrap up. I know you have maybe one or two more slides.
Yeah, I'm actually sure
we have some questions.
Yeah, I'm actually done. Thank you, Mr.
Oh.
And that wraps it up. You're perfect timing.
That is perfect timing. You are right on schedule.
Yeah, happy to take any questions, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, questions, members, and also we can go a few minutes late, too, if folks want to, get into more detail here. But I did want to... also see just again, I know Representative Petersburg played a key role here, and I don't know as the co-chair if you have any short comments that you would like to make, and then we'll open it up for committee questions. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think he did hit the highlights very well. I think what the difficulty we had is in Constitution, it talks about a lot of different things. When one of the things the Constitution did not do was define a trunk highway purpose. And that was kind of the challenge that we had in the committee in trying to create that and why we spent so much time trying to figure out what exactly is the definition of trunk highway purpose. Because without that definition, it does give a lot of deference, as he said, or flexibility for us as legislature and the department to determine what is and is not within that parameters. So we did try to spend a great deal of time, and I think where it got bogged down to was that there were some that really believed in more of a specific definition of trunk highway purpose versus those that were trying to convert that believed it was really more of a transportation system need rather than a highway purpose. And so that's where we kind of got down. And both positions have legitimate, you know, decisions. The question is just how do we fund that? And I think that's where we got a little sidetracked in trying to come up with that. So you'll see three different reports in the body of, about the body of the report from the three different, not necessarily factions, but differences of opinion in how we determine that. And you'll see that in the report. So it's worth the read. And I agree that it's going to be a very good reference into the future. And with that, I'll also answer any questions.
Thank you, members, or thank you, Representative Petersburg. Members, any questions, again, mainly for Representative Petersburg and Mr. Gustafson, or any comments as well, questions or comments? It's a really, I agree with Representative Petersburg that as a reference is something we can look at for the future, a really good body of work and a reference tool. Okay, let me see what we've got here. Don't have any questions or at this point. Representative Elkins, I don't know if you served on the task force. Do you have any very quick closing thoughts here before we adjourn?
Nothing really to add. I think the discussion from Mr. Gustafson and Representative Petersburg were spot on.
Great.
Mr. Okay. Chair, could I add one thing to
proceed, Mr. Gustafson? Absolutely.
Yeah, I think he made an excellent point. And just to give a little detail on the difference, we talked about a definition, for example, of what is construction, right? And proposal from Senator Newman that said construction means any activity that is directly related to the building and construction of a public trunk highway, where the agency proposal said construction of public highways means any activity that is directly related to or necessary for the administration and support of building and constructing the state trunk highway system. And then Representative Elkins had a similar proposal that was worded a little differently, but would encompass some of those support functions as well, such as financial, human resources, procurement, real estate, legal, and things like that. That was kind of where we ended up in specifics, is that you had the direct relationship in one proposal versus the addition of necessary for the administration and support in the other ones. And so I think Representative Petersburg is absolutely right. That's where we kind of hit an impasse. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, members. Okay, I don't see any questions or comments. So with that, members, again, this is I would anticipate our last committee hearing of this biennium. And I wanted to thank again our incredible staff, each and every member of this committee that has made wonderful contributions to our discussions over the last couple of years. And we still have a lot of work in front of us this session with an ongoing and very active conference committee. And we have members again who've been very engaged in that work even as it continues outside of our committee. So we will have one hopefully last transportation bill here to discuss at the end of session. And if any of you are interested in, of course, keeping up on the conference committee, or these are all public meetings, you're welcome to be a part of that and contact me, of course, with your questions and concerns. And a number of the issues that we discussed today are also being discussed in the conference committee. And so this was a very, very helpful hearing to inform that process. And so with that, members, we are adjourned and look forward to a good end of session and see you on the floor or virtually in the coming days. We are adjourned. Thank you, members.